very night, gathering with hundreds of others, thousands. And a wondrous thing happened. The kings called upon the desert gods, and they came. Tulathan, whose hair was molten silver, Rhea, whose skin shone golden, mighty Tharsh and dark Gojan. Baki came next, his bright smile lit by Tulathan and Rhea's light. Last was Yurinde, whose dark eyes reminded Mavra of her first love, who lived in the desert still. Mavra quaked merely to look upon them. Many of her grandchildren cried, but they were quickly shushed. They waited, all of them wondering if the gods would listen to the pleas of their kings. King Kiral strode forward, the 12 kings arrayed behind him. He was not a god himself, but Mavra would swear he looked like one of the gods' children, a man who might inherit the desert. Mavra looked often to Sihid Elaz, the king standing closest to her and her family. He was no sheikh, but the king of tribe Malaked here in Sharakai. She had never considered him her true king. She'd spent too long in the desert to think that, but this night she prayed for him to see them through. "Save my children," she prayed to her king. "Save them and I will fill your coffers with all I can spare. This I promise." No sooner had she made her wish than the King of Kings slowed in his speech. He spread his arms wide as if he might wrap them around the whole of Sharakai.
"Save our city," he begged the desert gods, "and what we have is yours."
Tulathan spoke, but Mavra could hardly hear the goddess's words, for Gojan had swung his head toward her whole family. With teeth made perfect for rending, he smiled. His tails lashed. His crown of thorns glinted beneath the twin moons, full and bright in the sky above. She forced herself to look away, to concentrate on Tulathan's words.
"You shall have your city and your desert too," she said in ringing tones. "But we require payment, a tribute of our own."
"You have but to speak it," said Kiral.
"Our price is dear," the goddess intoned.
"Nothing is too dear."
"Blood," said Tulathan.
"Blood," said Golden Rhea.
"We require blood," said Dark Gojan, finally drawing his gaze from Mavra.
The King of Kings paused. He took a deep breath as if gathering up his courage, and then he waved one hand towards Sihid Elaz and Mavra and all the rest, all those who hailed from tribe Malaked.
"And you will have it."
A gasp came from those gathered. Some ran, some rushed toward Sihid Elaz, begging for protection. Mavra, however, stood rooted to the spot. As Kiral had spoken his words of sacrifice, Gojan had swung his gaze to her once more. He watched hungrily as the change overcame her, as madness started to dawn. She ignored him as the feeling grew, looked instead to those around her. Her family was turning to ashes before her very eyes. Her body began to wither. Her pain began to mount. She turned back to Gojan as the seeds of a never-ending hunger were planted within her mind, urging her to obey, to never question, to give the kings anything they wanted.
"Go!" Kiral commanded. "Fly beyond the walls of Sharakai. Destroy those who thought to destroy us."
Mavra was compelled. It pained her to hold Gojan's gaze, to fight the growing compulsion within her, yet fight she did. How could the kings have done this? How could the gods have demanded it? Her most desperate hope, however, the thing she clung to like a rock in the midst of a terrible storm, was that she might still find a way to save her family. Might she plead to the kings, or to the gods,
Might she fight them if only to save one or two? The god of chaos stalked closer, tails lashing, the earth shaking with every step. She held her ground as he towered over her. Gojin's eyes glistened as he took her in.
"Defiance shall not save thee."
Her body quivered as the pain built inside her, but she would not give up. The dark god's amusement deepened.
"Nor shall thy pride."
She tried, breath of the desert, how she tried. But in the end, the pain, the hunger inside her, proved too strong. Her children called to her. They howled for her to join them as they bounded down the mountain. "Forgive me," she called to them. "You are my perfect treasures, and I have failed you all." They only howled louder. Unable to resist any longer, she followed them to deal death beyond the walls. Chaedah woke coughing from the vision. It took her long moments to shake the feeling of hunger within her. It was but an echo of Marvra's, the one that had driven her to hunt the desert tribes on Beth Iman, a hunger that drove her still. It would never leave her, Chaedah knew, nor her brood. Her brood. They were the other Asirim, the ones who had risen alongside her. Her children, her grandchildren. Breath of the desert, there had been three great-grandchildren as well. Chaedah saw them, crouched beneath one of the Adikara, huddled together like hungry orphans. Except what they hunger for is neither bread nor water, but the blood of the living. The very thought sent a deep pang of regret through her. Another echo from Marvra. Marvra had felt, still felt responsible. She should have protected them. Yet none of the other Asirim felt this way. Through it all, their centuries of pain, the terrible yokes the gods had lain across their shoulders, the will of the kings and the burden of pain they had inflicted on the children of Sharakai, they still looked to Marvra for guidance. And Marvra, for her part, though she wished she could have done more, had somehow managed this much, to keep them all together. Were the kings even aware that such love still existed beneath the blooming fields? Sumeya came forward until she stood by Chaedah's side. Chaedah had been so swept up in Marvra's story, she hadn't spared the other maidens a thought. But the stunned look on Sumeya's face made it clear she had seen it all. She was staring at Marvra, this wrinkled, blackened thing, with naked reverence. Chaedah could see the confusion, her thoughts warring within her. Melisse was much the same. "My tears!" For a time, Sumeya was lost to her own racking cries. When she recovered, she wiped her eyes and sniffled. "My tears, for your loss. No excuse can be given for this. No defense." She dropped to one knee. "My heart is sundered." Marvra stared down at her, the confusion in her jaundiced eyes echoing the warring emotions within her. But then Chaedah felt something new. A small shift in mood. Nothing more. A seed of dark emotion growing, its roots working deeper and deeper into her mind. Chaedah wasn't even sure Marvra knew herself what was happening, but it was a feeling that now echoed among her children, who were growing ever more restless at this blade maiden, a daughter of the kings, standing before their monarch. "Sumeya, get back." No sooner had Chaedah spoken than Marvra's hand lashed out. Sumeya jerked back, but Marvra's long nails still caught her across the throat. Blood flew and Sumeya's hand went to her throat as she rolled backward. Marvra followed her with a feral grin, She was so fixated on Sumeya she hardly reacted as Cheda stepped in and snapped a kick to her chest. Marva was heavy, solid, but Cheda had kicked her hard. She fell back, arms flailing into the thorny branches of the Adhikara. The Asirim around them howled louder than before, yet they didn't attack. Cheda was looking around for an escape route when she spied movement. A line of horses were charging hard toward their location. A dozen blade maidens with Husamatin at their lead, his great sword already drawn. Sayid rushed to help Sumeya up. Her eyes were wide. Blood flowed from beneath her fingers, making the cloth of her maiden's dress glint in the moonlight. As Marvra's brood began to close in, Cheda drew Sumeya's ebon blade. The passage leading to their horses was blocked. The one on the clearing's opposite side, however, the one leading away from Husamatin and the approaching horses, had only a few Asirim guarding it. She whistled a pair of signals that together meant retreat north, then led the way herself. Sumeya and Sayid fell in line behind her. Melis came last, slashing her sword to ward the Asirim away. The four fought their way along the passage between the trees, moving like a seasoned company of mercenaries. The Asirim seemed strangely slow. In the madness of the sudden battle, it took Cheda a moment to understand why. Husamatin had given them a commandment to stop or kill the traitors in their midst. But they were not yet wholly his. They had attained free thought through Cheda's blood and the sheer power of Marvra's will. It was likely the only reason Cheda made it to open sand, but make it she did, with the others close behind. They moved away from the Adhikara as quickly as they could, but gods, the speed of the Asirim! Already they were bounding past to cut off their escape. They ran in small, ragged groups, hounds, hungry for the desert hare. Melis whistled hard to call their horses. A short while later, Cheda saw them coming. Gods, if they could just make it to their mounts, they might yet escape. Melis whistled again, a reinforcement of the previous command and a call for the horses to break through any resistance they found. The lead horse, Sumeya's, was a terrible beast named White Knife. It crashed into the nearest Asirim, knocking several aside in a tumble of limbs and sand. Another was trampled as it tried to outrun the horse. When another Asir, the tallest of them all, faced the horse with arms wide, White Knife reared and swiped its forehooves wildly through the air. A loud crunch came as the Asir's skull was caved in. The Asir tipped over, arms quivering, its body rigid. Then White Knife ploughed forward once more while Marvra wailed in anguish as she watched her offspring crushed beneath a horse's hooves. The two horses following White Knife made it through, but the trailing horse, Melis's, was caught across its foreleg with a rake of long claws, then again along one shoulder. Blood flew, dark against the gauzy night sky, and the horse screamed, falling to the sand. A half-dozen Asirim descended, tearing it to pieces. As three horses neared, Melis and Cheda swung their swords broadly to ward away the nearest of the Asirim. In that moment, Husamatin, riding his stallion, Blackmane, burst from the tree line. He and his horse fairly flew over the desert, sand kicking in tails behind Blackmane's hooves. Husamatin rode low and tight to the saddle, reins in one hand. Knight's kiss, held in the other, high above his head. A dozen more maidens on horses galloped in his wake, each calling in high, melodic tones that sent a chill down Cheda's skin. For a moment, all her childhood fears of the Blade Maidens returned. Shaking them off, she helped Sumeya into the saddle, then swung up behind her and held her steady as Zayid and Melis mounted the other two horses. The Asirim, meanwhile, had backed away, an unspoken command from Husamatin, perhaps. She understood the truth a moment later. Marvra, still standing near the Adhikara, had lowered her bulk toward the ground. Crouching, she placed one palm against the sand. A rumbling shook the desert floor. Sand shifted. Stones skittered. Chayda could feel a buzzing in her teeth and in her bones. No sooner had their horses leaned into a gallop than they began to slow inexplicably. They nickered. Their eyes rolled. Their ears flicked this way and that as if they were being harassed by a cloud of gnats. Looking down, Chayda saw their legs sinking deep into the sand. The horses stamped their hooves, trying to stay above it, but the harder they struggled, the lower they seemed to sink. Gods, it was slip sand summoned by Marvra, whose hunger, anger and confusion Chayda could still feel. She wanted simultaneously to feast on Chayda's bones and deny the King of Swords that which he sought. The two desires warred within her, which gave Chayda hope. Allowing her own desperation to drive her, she wedged her will between Marvra and Husamatine. She had done the same in Ishmantep with Karim and Camille, but she took no care to spare either of them this time. She wielded her will like a knife, and Marvra, already so conflicted, couldn't take it. Her ungainly form crumpled to the sand like a sack of stones. Immediately the buzzing ceased. The horses, however, breath of the desert. The legs of all four of them were in so deep they could hardly move. As Marvra's brood wailed and flocked toward her, terrified their matriarch had just been killed, Melisse gave a quick series of whistles. East, ship approaching. Danger? Over the shallow dunes, Chayda spotted it. A skiff approaching fast. It was one she and Dadsada had sailed here. She could just make him out, sitting at the back, steering the craft. He stood and waved, beckoning her toward him.
"Quickly!"
he bellowed as he crested a dune and carved the ship around.
"Quickly now!"
"Come!" Chayda called to Zaid and Melisse. She slipped off the saddle and helped Sumeya to do the same. Zaid hesitated only a moment. After one glance at Husamatine and the Blade Maidens pounding after them, she headed for the skiff. Melisse came to help with Sumeya, who was still holding the bunched veil of her turban hard against the wound across her neck. Chayda made to go, but Sumeya pressed her hand to Chayda's chest and pointed to the saddlebag.
"The sword and the pack," she said.
Then she left with Melisse, the two of them loping toward the skiff. Chayda hadn't even realized it, but there was an ebon blade, a long white knife's back, mostly hidden by the saddlebag and bedroll. Using Sumeya's sword to cut the ties, she grabbed both, then followed the others. She knew, as she knew the tattoos on her own two hands, that this was River's daughter. Sumeya had brought it for her. She had been ready to believe Chayda. Perhaps she had even wanted to believe. As Chayda ran, her feet sank into the sand like mud, but by moving quickly she was able to reach a normal swathe of sand. Hooves pounded behind her, charging ever closer. They were nearing the strip of slip sand, but Husamatine gave it a wide berth, affording them a few more precious seconds to reach the skiff. Ahead, Dadsada had pulled the skiff to a stop. He was now bent over and striking something over and over. Sparks lit in time with the frantic movements of his arm, illuminating his pillowy face and long beard. As Zaid, Melisse, Sumeya came near, he lifted a small bow. On it was an arrow with a cloth tip that burned with a sinister green flame. What in the great wide desert he was going to do with it, Chayda had no idea, but gods, she hoped it was something good. As Zaid fairly rolled Sumeya into the front of the skiff, Dadsada stomped down onto something affixed to the central thwart. A loud thudding sound accompanied a round pot flying into the night sky. A dark cloud trailed behind it. Powder, Chayda realized as it fell across her path. The pot struck in the path of the oncoming horses and broke. Powder burst outward in a cloud. As Dardzada took aim with his bow, Zayd climbed onto the rear thwart and took the tiller, while Melisse and Cheda pushed hard against the transom. Dardzada's burning arrow flew. It streaked through the night, a burning emerald star. When it came near the fallen pot, the yellowish-green flames flew outward as if Thash himself had come bearing a piece of the sun. Where the powder had been borne by the wind, flames followed, but it went well beyond. The sound of it barreled unevenly along the lee of the dune like the cackle of hyenas. A moment later, a thoom sound filled the air. Horses screamed and threw their heads back. Black mane reared wildly, forehooves raking the air. Husamitin managed to keep his saddle, but when Blackmane dropped back down, he danced away from the flames, heedless of his master's wishes. Meanwhile, the fire snaked backward. Like a bloodhound on a runaway's scent, it followed the trail of powder that had drifted down from the pot. A roiling, uneven column billowed in its wake. It came on so fast, so hard that Cheda barely had time to turn away before it was on her. Where the powder had touched the sleeves of her dress, it was now aflame. It lit along her wrists as well. She leapt into the skiff, and then Dardzada was on her, patting out the flames with quick, precise slaps of his meaty hands. As the flames were snuffed and the skiff picked up speed, heading deeper into the desert, Cheda looked back. Several of the horses and maidens were on fire. Those that weren't were now spooked, even Blackmane. They galloped and bucked, many of them neighing and screaming. When Husamitin finally regained control, Dardzada's skiff was deep into the desert, too far to follow. The fire burned, outlining Husamitin's silhouette as he watched from the top of a dune. Several maidens rode to their king's side, one of them hulking above the others. Camille, most likely. They all grew smaller and smaller as the skiff sailed on, and the immensity of what Cheda and the others had done began to wash over her. The first warden and a sister maiden were willingly fleeing from a king of Sharakai with a spy, a scarab, and a traitor. Behind, the fire shrank in on itself, sputtered and went out, and the King of Swords and his maidens were swallowed by the night. Chapter 48. Ramad rode with Amaryllis in a covered araba through the temple district in one of the worst sandstorms anyone in the city could remember. They were headed toward Thash's temple, where a shrine to the grassland god Onondu was being consecrated. The temple's high priest was set to meet with King Kharal, many of Sharakai's highborn, and a large delegation from Kundun. Wind buffeted the carriage, its symphonic creaking mixing with the clatter of wheels and the clop of hooves. They were making their way over a narrow, cobbled street. Amaryllis craned her neck to peer through the side window to the way ahead, which was choked with carriages. Passengers at the front were disembarking and running up the temple steps to escape the wind.
"Mighty Alu," Ramad grumbled. "A dead goat could get us there faster."
When they crept forward and came to another creaking halt, he'd had enough. He knocked on the roof and bellowed through the window.
"Let us out here!"
He and Amaryllis left the driver to his own fate and headed up the street, occasionally raising an arm to protect against the biting wind. Turiat loomed over the shoulders of the temples, but with the sand so thick, it was a featureless mound, its many palaces lost to the weather. As they walked, Ramad put a hand to his stomach. He yawned, trying to clear away the nausea. His attention, as it had been the whole way here, was drawn beyond the temples, beyond Sharakai. Since Meriem's alterations to the sigil stones last night, Guldrathan's presence had been growing.
Ramad hadn't slept at all. The dread inside him had grown to great, and at that time the Arek had still been leagues out into the sand. Not any more. Closer and closer it had come, all throughout the morning hours, each increment twisting Ramad's insides further. Then several hours ago it had halted near the city's outskirts, as if wary of entering. It was Meriem's doing. Using her newfound power from the trapped Rumayesh, she had woven in a way to make Guldrathan aware of the city's wards. The danger was that Guldrathan would come anyway, and well before the summoning ritual, but so far the gods had been kind. The beast's patience was outweighing its thirst for revenge. Soon Meriem would erase all awareness of the sigils, and at the same time inflame the beast's anger. Guldrathan would come, they were both sure. The only question was, how quickly? Guldrathan was an ancient beast, and sly. It might wait longer than they wished, or come too quickly, its thirst for Ramad's blood driving it to rash behaviour. Amaryllis squeezed Ramad's arm.
Ahead, my lord. Face the way ahead as if nothing is the matter.
Of course.
Ramad wiped the cold sweat from his brow. It was paramount that he not let his fears give him away. He was attending the ceremony precisely because Guldrathan was chasing him. The thinking was that it would focus on Khamzakir once it caught his scent.
Khamzakir is the key, Ramad reminded himself. He is the key to all of this.
Kiral had told Meriem that he and Khamzakir would meet in the temple after the ritual was complete. They were to discuss plans so sensitive that it could only be done face to face. Khamzakir had also agreed to return some of the elixirs he had stolen on the Night of Endless Swords, elixirs Kiral desperately wanted. Such a thing could never be done in the House of Kings. The ways in and out of Turiat were watched by too many spies beholden to the other kings, but a simple ceremony in the temple district? It was the sort of menial task most kings hated. As long as Kiral did nothing to draw attention to it beforehand, the others would suspect nothing. And for Khamzakir's part, the temple was open enough that it could be watched to ensure he wasn't betrayed. And yet, Ramad still wondered whether this was a fool's errand, a slow and very painful way to commit suicide. Khamzakir might smell the trap and decide not to come. Or he might have the foresight to mask himself from detection, from Guldrathan among others. He wouldn't know the Arek was coming for him. If he did, he wouldn't come at all. But he might have worked a spell to hide his presence from other blood magi, a thing that might hide his presence from Guldrathan as well.
"The way ahead, my lord,"
Amaryllis said, tugging harder on his arm. Ramad squeezed her hand as they neared the foot of the temple's steps.
"Of course."
Steeling himself, he ignored his growing nausea and dedicated himself to studying the sizable crowd on the steps ahead of them. Making up the bulk of the crowd were tall Kunduni men and women, perhaps 36 in all. Several children were among them, some holding the hands of their elders, others running up and down the stairs. One dark-skinned boy was kicking a paddle of sand that had gathered along the steps. The sand sprayed when he kicked, creating a momentary cloud that was immediately thrown skyward by the prevailing wind. Others were Sharakani men and women wearing fine clothing. Their turbans and veils were pulled tight, while the hems of their thobes and dresses flapped fiercely. These were lords and ladies of the city, guests of Kiral and the other kings of Sharakai. When Amaryllis and Ramad reached the head of the stairs, they were greeted warmly by the high priest, a burly man with a bald head and a thick red beard and fists
that looked like they could break stone.
Good of you to come,
he said to them, his deep voice carrying easily above the wind.
Of course, Ramad shouted. It's too bad the weather isn't cooperating. This?
The priest waved around, smiling with pinched eyes and rounded cheeks.
What else should we expect? Thash and Anandu have met, and it's glorious.
Even in those few moments, more sand and dust gathered in his beard. A man turning to stone before their very eyes.
Come!
He roared to the crowd, waving them all to follow.
Come! It's time!
Most had already moved into the temple, but the stragglers now followed the priest into the most Spartan of the city's temples. They made their way through its heart, the sound of the wind waning momentarily, and to the rear, where a great lawn with several gardens and shrines was situated. Thankfully, the wind was not so strong here. The priest led them to the newest of the shrines, a circular arrangement of white travertine pillars topped by a ring of obsidian stone. The shrine had no roof, a nod to how Anandu has been welcomed by Thash to the desert. As if the two of them might sit there, cross-legged and talk beneath the stars. In the center of the shrine was a stout pedestal of simple sandstone, and upon it a massive piece of carved ivory. A horn, it was said, from a beast of the Kunduni grasslands. The carving was the work of an artisan, one of Kiral's great-great-grandchildren, it was said, and depicted a tribe of grassland warriors who had gathered with spears and shields to kill the very beast that had given up the ivory. It was made in honour of the territory Kundun, now patrolled for the kings in the western reaches of the great Shangazi. The one who seemed proudest of the sculpture was also the eldest of the Kunduni tribesmen. A man with wild hair and great golden rings in his ears and nose. He was a king of the grasslands, the very one who had agreed to patrol the western desert for pirates. The priest was regaling him with the story of the horn and the artist who had carved it when a new train of people exited from the rear of the temple. King Kiral was at their head, striding tall, eyes pinched, as the wind and sand drove him forward. His left hand rested on the pommel of Sunshear, his great two-handed shamshir. A hand of blade maidens in their dark dresses and veiled turbans followed. Trailing behind were 24 courtiers, their bright jewellery and thread of gold clothing a glinting counterpoint to the amber haze in the air that tended to mute all other colours. All bowed as Kiral stepped into the shrine. The King of Kings was introduced to the tribal king, a pleasantry filled with so little humour and warmth one might think them newly reconciled enemies. The high priest seemed to notice and launched into his prepared speech shortly after. It was when he began anointing the ivory horn with rosewood oil that Ramad felt a change. His awareness of Gurdravan increased so sharply it sent pain through his heart. A cough escaped him. His left arm went numb and tingly, as if it had fallen asleep. The same feeling started along the fingertips of his right hand and began creeping up his arm. He worked his hands into fists, pumping the blood, hoping to ease the alarming numbness without drawing attention to himself. But even that simple act was difficult. All thoughts bent toward survival. Even breathing had become a chore. It felt as if 1,000 needles were being driven through his chest. Another cough escaped him, this time earning him stares, including a dour look from King Kiral. But what did Ramad care? Gurdravan had broken through the city wall and was hurtling toward them. The fear that had been slowly building was no longer an insubstantial thing. It had seized him.
It was as real as the shrine, or the bloody great horn the priest was rubbing with oil, or Keral's god-given shamshir, or the storm that was scouring the city raw. Without meaning to, Ramad took a step back. He bumped into a Sharakani man who frowned deeply at him. The simple contact sent bright shards of pain running along his left arm. Someone, Amaryllis, grabbed his hand, but it was so painful he gasped and pulled away. Amaryllis whispered something, but her words were lost as Ramad stared to his left beyond the wall bordering the temple grounds. He saw only tall stone buildings cloaked in amber. But he knew Guldrathan was coming from that direction, knew that it would reach the wall in moments. A crash of stone sounded in the distance. Sounds of alarm broke out. People screamed. Some had been staring at Ramad, perhaps wondering what was the matter with him. But now, as one, the crowd turned toward the wall. The Blade Maidens drew their swords, and two of them flanked their king. The other three advanced beyond the shrine and onto the lawn. Several in the crowd gasped as two black horns lifted above the wall. They shouted, backed away, scooping up their children as they went. A great head rose above the wall's decorative lip. Yellow eyes peered through the dusty wind. When its black hand touched the wall, the stones cracked, then crumbled, flaking away as if made of so much caked sand. Guldrathan took one long stride onto the temple grounds as the wall collapsed completely. The erect's tails whipped behind it. Corded muscles spread its arms wide. It hunkered low, as if ready to do battle against Tharsh himself, should he appear to defend his sacred ground.
"My king!"
one of the Blade Maidens shouted.
"To the temple!"
But the king ignored her and drew his sword. He didn't advance on the Erech, but neither did he retreat. The beast was speaking, Ramad realized. Its right hand was moving in strange ways, as if it were drawing arcane symbols in the air. Indeed, as it continued, a strange ochre light trailed behind its hands and tails. Something pressed upon Ramad's body, slowing him as he instinctively backed away. It felt as if he were moving through slipsand. Soon he had come to a complete halt. His body was caught in amber, a slave to the Erech's magic. Only his eyes could move, and even that simple movement was slowed to a crawl. The same had happened to everyone in Ramad's field of vision. They stood rooted to the stone beneath them, even the king. The Erech approached, its forked tongue tasting the air. Sand gathered in its crown of thorns, just as it had in the priest's beard. When it shook its head, the sand sprayed outward, like silt in the eddies of a river. The sand was caught by the same magic. It moved in odd, expressive increments, matching the lift of Guldrathan's muscled arm, the turn of its horned head, as if even the air now obeyed Guldrathan's will. Guldrathan had been heading straight for Ramad, but as it neared the edge of the crowd, it slowed. Its nostrils flared while its head tilted to one side.
Hamzakir.
It approached a young Kunduni woman with braids, huge silver hoop earrings, and a choker made of tiny red beads.
Where dost thou hide?
It said to her, though clearly it was meant for them all. Guldrathan lifted the woman off the ground. The only outward sign of her emotion was her breath, which had devolved into rapid, wheezing inhalations, followed by outward huffs like moans of pain. Guldrathan smiled, a host of leonine teeth.
art thou inside?
With sickening leisure, the Arek used the claws on its thumbs to prise open the woman's chest, as if she were little more than a jackfruit. Blood spurted outward, coating the Arek's ebony skin. The woman's innards spilled like coiled rigging. The Arek ran its forked tongue along the ruin of her chest cavity, and then, displeased, tossed her aside in one violent motion that sent her skidding over the ground like an ill-favoured doll until she crashed hard against the trunk of a distant palm tree. Guldrathan continued forward, gripping a man Ramad had seen earlier, holding hands with the woman who had just been torn apart. It repeated the ritual on him.
That thou hoped to hide from my vengeance,
it said as it took up a third, a young man no older than 16 summers.
It doth please me.
It tore the poor boy in two, tossing the remnants aside like trash on a midden. As it chose its fourth victim, Ramad remembered his time with Hamza Kia in Via Rosa in Almadan in the desert. Time and time again he had been able to throw off Hamza Kia's spells. Hamza Kia had even commented on it on the deck of the ship, shortly before they had been taken to the blasted plain and given to Guldrathan. Ramad had had few enough occasions to use his gift since, but he found his sense of it growing once again. He pushed, as he had in Santrion while trying to prevent Hamza Kia from taking King Alduan. He pushed, as he had in the hold of the ship, before walking up on deck, ready to take Hamza Kia's life if he could. He pushed, and he found himself able to move his arms, able to shift one foot. His freedom was coming too slowly, however. Guldrathan was stepping closer to Ramad. Amaryllis stood directly in its path. Her back was to the Arek, but she could hear it coming closer. Her nostrils flared, a tear streamed down one cheek. When Guldrathan used its tail to grab a Sharakani man around the neck and whip him aside, leaving his path to Amaryllis clear, something inside Ramad broke. He took one agonizing step forward, then another. As Guldrathan reached for Amaryllis, he grabbed her arm and pulled her away. The Arek tried again, faster this time, but Ramad was already dragging her backward. He tripped over someone's foot, and Amaryllis tumbled with him. Guldrathan towered over him, its eyes glinted. Its mouth opened in something like a smile.
Thrice have mine eyes laid upon your form. Twice have I given thee leave to go. Not again, child of Chimere.
It took one long stride toward Ramad as he tried in vain to scramble away.
Not again.
The claws of its reaching hand had just wrapped around Ramad's left leg when it roared in pain. Releasing Ramad's leg, it twisted around to face the threat. King Keral was there, his sword, Sunshearer, at the ready. The blade was bloody, and Ramad could see a deep gash on Guldrathan's back. One of Guldrathan's tails whipped toward Keral. The king delivered a blinding uppercut. The barbed end of Guldrathan's tail flew into the air from the point of contact. Black blood flowed as the severed end toppled through the strangely thick air. But the second tail had flown beneath the king's guard. It stabbed deeply into the king's thigh. Blood gushed from the wound as Keral backed away. Guldrathan powered forward. Keral dodged, swinging Sunshearer in broad arcs to keep the Arek at bay. How he had managed to throw off the effects of the spell Ramad wasn't certain, but the kings had many gifts from the gods. Could this not be one of them? Whatever the case, he was fast and powerful and managed to strike several more deep gashes into Gurdrathan's black flesh. It couldn't last, though. The Erech was simply too powerful. When Kiral retreated beneath the shrine, Gurdrathan drove one fist into a pillar, collapsing one side of the structure. As Kiral rolled away, it picked up a massive round pillar stone and launched it at Kiral. It struck, only a glancing blow, but the stone was so weighty it was still enough to send Kiral tumbling to the ground. He came up, favoring his left side, his right shoulder hanging low, the arm perhaps useless. He managed one deep cut into Guldrathan's leg as the Erech charged, but took a backhanded blow while doing so. Kiral was down, as useless as Ramad had been only moments ago. But something strange had happened. Whether it was from the damage Guldrathan had sustained, or something else. Movement was returning to the gathered crowd. Most moved, as if trapped in honey. But one man was now sprinting away, as if he had not been affected by Gordrathan's spell at all. The Sharakani man who'd frowned when Ramad had bumped into him. Nonetheless, Guldrathan's focus seemed to be only on King Kiral. But then the beast slowed, turned, and fixed its jaundiced eyes on the running man. One moment it seemed confused, but then its eyes lit in recognition. It bellowed as it dropped to all fours and began pounding over the earth. Many of the ritual goers were crushed as Guldrathan closed the distance. A woman who'd fallen screamed as a cloven hoof crunched down onto her leg. The fleeing man, perhaps knowing the end was near, stopped and faced Guldrathan. That was when Ramad saw his form change. A round, well-shaven face elongated into Hamzakir's drawn features and pepper-grey beard. As Meriem had suspected, he'd been here all along. As Guldrathan came nearer, a bright ball of flame formed between Hamzakir's outstretched hands. It grew quickly in size. Ramad could feel it, an awareness of magic being coaxed, thread-like from the ether. Ramad was hardly aware of what he did next. It was more akin to a reflexive parry than anything else. He reached outward, drew upon the threads of magic Hamzakir relied upon for his spell, and severed them. The flame flew from Hamzakir's hands, breaking apart like the shards of a shattered urn. The shards flew in crazy patterns, bright but ineffective against Guldrathan's fearsome charge. When Hamzakir tried again, Ramad stopped his spell entirely, cutting him off from his power before he could even gather it. Hamzakir's eyes then met Ramad's. There was a split second of recognition in which the two of them shared a look of mutual hatred. And then the Erech was on him. Hamzakir was forced to the ground, where Guldrathan clamped its massive jaws over his chest. Half of it was ripped free in one explosive wrench of its great horned head. But in that moment, as Hamzakir's screams mixed with the howling of the wind, Ramad felt a spell trigger. In a blink, much faster than Ramad could react, Hamzakir's soul was whisked away. Like a stream of sand slipping through an hourglass, he was transported, leaving behind something poorer and dimmer, perhaps the soul of the man whose body he had stolen to attend the ceremony. Ramad had little more than a vague sense of direction.
South, he realized. Hamzakir has gone south.
Guldrathan sensed it too. It paused its bloody rending of Hamzakir's former body and stared in the same direction as Ramad. With a bellow that sounded like a blast from the fabled horn that presaged the end of days,
Guldravan hurtled toward the southern wall. The stone began to crack even before it came near, and when Guldravan lowered its head and crashed into it, it crumbled beneath the onslaught. Soon the erect form was obscured, then lost altogether, swallowed by the cloud of dust kicked up by its passage.
"Away!"
called one of the Blade Maidens. Ramad turned to find Amaryllis kneeling beside King Kiral. She had the skirt of her dress pressed against the worst of Kiral's wounds, the one along his thigh. The Blade Maidens had imposed themselves between Guldravan and their king, and had only now realized that Amaryllis was there. The nearest of the Blade Maidens, their warden, was the one who had shouted at Amaryllis,
"I said away!"
She grabbed the back of Amaryllis's ivory dress and yanked her back.
"Forgive me," Amaryllis said. "I only saw him in pain and thought to help."
Kiral's wounds were serious. The puncture to his thigh. A terrible gash along his ribs. The white cloth of his khalat glistened red all along his left side. Amaryllis's ivory dress likewise now shone with the king's blood. The warden dropped to her knees to help the king herself, while the other four maidens from her hand, their ebon blades at the ready, pushed Amaryllis and everyone else back. Some rushed to help the rest of the wounded. Others stood dumbstruck, their expressions a mixture of relief and shock and concern. Most of all, though, they looked wary, as if worried Guldravan might return at any moment. And well they might. Ramad could still sense Guldravan moving away, but who was to say he wouldn't return if Khamzakir escaped? Soon all had been moved into the temple, the king included. Shortly after, the king was whisked away in a carriage. Everyone else was questioned, first by the maidens and later by a host of interrogators from the Silver Spears. The Erek had come for him, they said, and he had been seen fighting Khamzakir. When they called Ramad for questioning, they pressed him hard, asking him what he knew of Guldravan's attack, of Khamzakir's presence in the crowd. Ramad, however, told them he knew nothing, that he was only trying to protect himself and later, when he had spotted Khamzakir, to bring the villain to justice. They seemed unconvinced, and intimated that they would soon take him and Amaryllis, perhaps even Queen Meriem, to the garrison for further questioning. A process they would not enjoy, Ramad was assured. But miraculously, word came from Eventide. They were to be allowed to leave immediately, and Kiral himself would speak to them when he had recovered sufficiently. Upon receiving the news, the captain of the spears stared at Ramad, his discontent plain to see, but he grudgingly accepted the order and allowed both Ramad and Amaryllis to go. As the sun was setting, they were back in their araba, heading for the embassy house and to Meriem. Amaryllis was quiet, Ramad too. He couldn't stop staring at the dark stain on her dress. Blood. From the King of Kings. Chapter 49. Sailing at night was dangerous business, but it was necessary if Chayda and the others were to have any hope of escaping Husamatine and the Blade Maidens. No doubt they'd mounted a search, and as fast as some of the navy ships were, they'd have to be careful in the days ahead to keep their skiff on the move. Sumer's neck wound was bad. Despite the danger of being seen, they lit a small lantern so that Dardzada could tend to her while Melis took the tiller. The wound was deep and caused pain when she tried to speak, forcing Sumer to whisper if she spoke at all. After cleaning the wound thoroughly, adding a dozen stitches and applying a salve to fight off infection, Dardzada had declared it sufficient.
"Don't strain it, or you'll sound like a talking lizard for the rest of your life."
I'll be fine,
Sumer said in a rasp. Dardzada's only response was to put his finger to his lips and let out a long shh. He'd given the order to Sumer, but everyone, including Cheda, obeyed it. They sailed in silence, and the sun eventually rose. The events of the previous night washed over them in different ways. They spoke only rarely, to pass food or water, to change the dressing on Sumer's wound, to discuss their heading or to pass the bucket they used to piss and shit in, rather than halt the skiff. Dardzada plotted their course over the desert. They all knew they were heading to join the 13th tribe, and no one balked. At least not outwardly, not until sundown.
We've given up every dram of power we once had, Sumer whispered, wincing as she spoke. You would return for it?
Melisse asked, though it hardly seemed she cared. Her voice was devoid of emotion. She was staring at the setting sun, her broad face unreadable. She had unwrapped her turban so that it hung like a cowl around her shoulders, leaving the wind to tug at her curls of hair. It was a strangely intimate thing, as if with that simple alteration to her uniform, she'd given up her status as a blade maiden, allowing all to see her as she was, a woman with a kind face full of freckles that spoke of younger years in the sun. She was quick to smile, though she rarely made jokes of her own. She was also quick to bite if she felt you'd been unjust. She was as fair a woman as Cheda had ever found in the House of Maidens, and now the very thing she had believed in since she was old enough to talk had been proven a lie.
If I could but speak to Camille, Sumer said.
Melisse barked a laugh.
Camille? She would as soon kiss a cobra as speak to any of us.
No, she would listen.
Sumer's words were sharp, as if the one she was trying to convince was herself.
If I could get her away from the others, she would listen.
And there's the rub, Zaid said. The kings will be watching her as closely as they will Indris, as closely as they will Sayabim. They'll do the same to everyone we knew. They're likely to give some over to Cahill for questioning after last night.
Sumer blinked, her brown eyes bright in the light of the lowering sun. She looked lost, utterly lost, as if the ramifications were only beginning to hit her.
They'll question my mother, my sister and her husband. Their children will be watched.
At least they're alive to be watched,
Dardzada said, echoing Cheda's own thoughts. Sumer stared at him, her eyes going straight through him. Cheda thought about telling them stories from her childhood, stories of the king's cruelties, stories they would now see in a different light. But tell them while they were in a state of shock, and it would be for her own benefit, not theirs. A way for Cheda to exorcise the hatred that had been building since her mother's death. Sumer and Melisse needed time to work through everything and to see the centuries of pain caused by the kings. It had taken a lot of courage for them to trust her, especially Sumer, first warden of the Blade Maidens. Cheda would never have guessed she would listen to the story of the 13th tribe, but she had. She had wanted to know the truth, and she would have questions, many questions. Until then, Cheda would let her be.
Ship!
Dardzada called. They all turned south and saw a ship in the distance. It didn't look like a navy ship, but they'd all agreed that no ships, even caravan ships, would be allowed to see them if it could be avoided. The chance of word getting back to the kings was simply too great. Cheda lifted the tiller, breaking their skiff into a trough between the dunes. Melisse and Zaid pulled down the sail, then lifted the mast and laid it across the prow. They watched and waited as another ship came into view, then another
and another. 14 in all flowed across the sand. It took nearly 2 hours until they'd all passed by and slipped from sight. Chader fretted the whole time.